It seems to be an immutable law of the sea that the passing of time has a magnifying effect on our artifacts. In the 1930s, the biggest ship in the world displaced around 80,000 tons. The Queen Mary was the marvel of the age. Yet 50 years later, the tanker Seawise Giant was launched at well over 500,000 tons. Somewhat earlier, as soon as the recognisable square-rigged cargo ship had identified herself as a genus, she grew steadily with advancing technology until effectively superseded by steam in the late Victorian era. The same thing is happening to our yachts. No statistics for this fall to hand, but the evidence suggests that in 30 years the average family cruiser has ballooned from 30 feet to nearer 40. One of these days I intend to tackle the complex issues involved in why many of us believe, or perhaps imagine, that bigger boats will deliver more enjoyment from our leisure. This month, however, we can shirk this important issue by sitting back in our spacious saloons and contemplating the quaint ways of paradox. In the 1850s, 35-foot lugged-rigged herring drifters were the mainstay of the Scottish North Sea fishing industry. The nature of their calling meant that they had to spend all night at sea with the sails usually furled, taking the rough weather with the smooth, lying to net after net strung together and streamed out far over their bows. If they got it right, the shoals of herring swimming up in the silent mystery world of the undersea moonlight would move athwart the nets and be trapped, their gills inextricably enmeshed. Hauling in the catch was literally back-breaking labour, but if it were a good one, the boats would come rollicking home to Bucky or Wick, their decks awash with the silver darlings. Profits were good and the future bright. Sure enough, 40 years on, what do we see? Herring luggers coming out of Peterhead and Fraserburgh, measuring 70 feet or more on deck. Their nets cost as much as the boat and were measurable in miles. These craft were the full summer flowering of lug sails in Scotland. Given the right conditions, the mighty plum-stemmed Fifi or her speedy, rakish sister the Zulu could fly past one of the new six-knot steam coasters, but there lies the catch. These huge luggers had masts weighing a ton, which had to be lowered into crutches in a rolling sea. Their flax canvas sails required monumental manpower to hoist. The only sensible way to manage these tasks was with a steam capstan. The capstan gobbled the jobs. It also hove in the miles of nets tirelessly, leaving the men free to shake the fish from the meshes and coil down the lines. In effect, steam made the biggest luggers possible. But it wasn't long before someone worked out that if you rotated the capstan drive by 90 degrees, put a propeller on the end and powered up the engine, you'd have a steam drifter. And that was the knell of sail. The very technology that made its greatest manifestation feasible spelled its doom as surely as the moving finger writing on Belshazzar's wall. Never mind that the sailing boat was faster. All of us know only too well there are more headwinds than fair, and more calm days than quartering force fours. And so, while the giant fishing craft may have extinguished their more modest predecessors for a while, in due course the whirligig of time brings in his revenges. As an old astro-navigator, I never miss up a chance to check my wristwatch, because in the world before GPS, a 4-second inaccuracy meant a 1-mile error on the chart. This morning, as the pips came up on the new bedside radio, I noted with horror that this well-tested timepiece, normally rated against the analogue radio synchronising device in my very clever car, had unexpectedly jumped several seconds. As my mug of tea began to boot up my brain, it dawned on me that because the new radio was digital, it was on some sort of delay and was lying when it purported to deliver universal time. Perhaps the same applies to those internet sites that check your watch, I wondered. I still don't know the answer to that one, but it tickled me to think that the good old pips that have served my navigation so well are being compromised by, of all things, advancing technology. The mud won't really hit the helicopter blades, of course, until they finally switch off analogue radio altogether, and perhaps by then an answer will have been found. Meanwhile, unless I can crank up an analogue signal from somewhere other than my car, I shall be reduced to scouring the menus of the boat's GPS to verify my watch. The readout there is exact to the nanosecond, I understand, whatever that may be worth, in a world run by two-legged beasts whose heart rate only hits 120 beats a minute on the occasional sprint to the pub before it shuts. The irony, of course, is that in order to use my sextant efficiently, unless I have rated my chronometer so it's good for a full voyage without the reassurance of a periodic check, I'll have to ship a GPS to authenticate it. This instrument, not content with putting my watch on its stainless steel back, will also bang out a position whether I like it or not. If it's doing this for me, what need have I a sextant? Or more specifically, what need have I of the accurate time which it demands? With GPS running the show, it wouldn't be a hanging matter if my watch were out by 5 minutes. I wonder what time's ever rolling stream will make of all that 100 years from now.